From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from earlier this year. Actress and comedian Phoebe Robinson discusses her book, You Can't Touch My Hair, and Other Things I Still Have to Explain. Award-winning songwriter Carol Bayer-Sager discusses her new memoir, They're Playing Our Song. And singer Ellis Hall talks about his career and his latest symphony project called Soul Unlimited. But first, it's well known that black voters have overwhelmingly supported the Democratic Party since the 1960s. According to the political website 538, Republican nominees have received, on average, 7% of the black vote since the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what is political life like for black conservatives? According to my next guest, Professor Corey Fields, the relationship between black Republicans and their party of choice is complex. He wrote about his findings in a new book called Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African-American Republicans. Professor Fields, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Let me start here, mm-hmm. Which is, what did you learn about how these black Republicans, whoever they may be, reconcile their black identity with the Republican Party, its principles, and what it stands for, what it promulgates?
Right. I mean, the most interesting thing was that there was variation in that. There wasn't one way that they did it. So going into the project, you know, my impression of black Republicans was shaped just like most other people's, from like the people who you see on the news, the people who end up speaking at, you know, the convention, Republican convention, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And that tends to be one message, right? Sort of a sort of tough-talking black Republican, mm-hmm. who was saying, black folks, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, mm-hmm. you know, sort of stop complaining about racism. So going into the project, that's what I was expecting, right, to get a lot of that and sort of hearing how people reconcile that. But surprisingly, actually, I found a lot of people who sort of talked about their Republican partisanship as sort of a form of pro-black politics, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of a black power through conservative principles kind of approach. And so for me, it was interesting to see, you know, these different strategies, right, sort of saying, I care about black people, but what's best for black people are conservative social policies, mm-hmm. versus, you know, the best thing for black people is to stop talking about race. Now, those two different approaches get very different responses within the party, right? And so, you know, if you're sort of race-conscious black Republican, you often find yourself marginalized, right? Even though you support the same policies as the rest of the party, and, you know, so you have a strategy for trying to get more black people involved, there's less interest in sort of promoting a message of sort of pro-black conservative politics. And so that's why our image of black Republicans so often ends up being someone who, you know, sort of sounds a lot like a white Republican.
You mentioned race conscious. Yeah. One of the things I learned from your text is that you discovered that there are really, at least you put them in two different categories, two different kinds of black Republicans.
Exactly.
One would be the race conscious black Republicans,
exactly,
that you referenced a moment ago,
right,
who don't get much love,
right,
inside the party.
Exactly.
Surprise, surprise. And the other group of black Republicans would be race blind,
exactly,
black Republicans. Tell me a bit more about the distinction between the two.
Yeah, I mean, big distinction between the two is sort of how they conceptualize the role of race and racism, mm-hmm. in structuring the black experience, right? For race-blind black Republicans, many will say, you know, there's an acknowledgement that racism is a real thing, but when you think about a sort of hierarchy, mm-hmm. of black people's problems, race-blind black Republicans will say, you know, racism isn't what's holding you back. It's your own, you know, sort of like inability to get with the program, or mm-hmm. your unwillingness to, you know, buckle down, right? They mm-hmm. sort of isolate sort of individualist explanations, or even sort of talk about cultural pathologies within the black community as being the locus of problems mm-hmm. that black people face. And then they link that, right, these ideas about black people to conservative social policies, right? So the Republican Party makes sense because the Republican Party isn't interested in sort of racial identity politics, which, you know, I mean, as this latest election has shown, is not necessarily true, right? It's just that the racial politics the party doesn't seem interested in are sort of mostly focused on, you know, thinking about racial minorities,
yeah,
right? Sort of having those identities be prominent within the party.
Yeah. I thought to ask you, I'm still thinking to ask you, how these black Republicans today mm-hmm. justify, explain, rationalize their support of a candidate like Donald Trump. But as I'm thinking to ask you that, I'm actually checking myself, because I don't know that it's fair to ask how black Republicans can justify, you know, I'm going with this, right?
Right.
Any more than the white Republicans can justify Donald Trump. So
exactly.
is the question that I was about to ask an unfair question?
I would say it's a little bit unfair, right? And this is something they sort of struggle with. And I definitely feel like one of the takeaways after doing the research was it's completely legitimate to look at a black Republican and say, why are you doing this? How are you doing this? I don't understand how you can support this kind of policy, right? Yeah. But I think you would have to ask those same questions of a white Republican, right? Like, I feel like there isn't anything particularly especially unreasonable about a black Republican supporting Donald Trump any more than a white Republican supporting Donald Trump. But the reality is we do have expectations around sort of like how political preferences are supposed to manifest based on social identities like race. So I understand the question, and it makes a lot of sense, but I think, you know, in some ways, it's the same question we should be asking every Republican.
Yeah. So I take that. That's why I caught myself before I ask it. But I think what is...
But still.
But still, how do they justify?
How do they do it? Right, exactly. No, completely reasonable. Completely reasonable. It's one of these things, right?
Right.
I can say this all day, and I've been saying it all day in the book.
Yeah.
But it still is this open question of how do you do it, right? And the reality is a lot of them aren't doing it, right? You're seeing black Republicans sort of say, this is a bridge too far, right? I've stood by the Republican Party, and when a lot of people were calling me a sellout, a lot of people were calling me an Uncle Tom, and this is the repayment I get now, having to defend Donald Trump. And you see a lot of black Republicans sort of, you know, jumping ship. And
But I think what is fair, though, Corey, I think what is a legitimate question, not that that is illegitimate, but what is, I think, more legitimate, perhaps, is questioning how they support the party, because Trump is an individual. And as we all know, he's just upended the whole apple cart this time around. He's just the most unique nominee that party has ever put forth. So we all get that.
Right.
But there is a legitimate question, again, to be asked about how they support a party that advances policies that many of us see as antithetical to the best interest of black people. That ain't a Trump question. That's a GOP question.
Exactly. Okay. And I think part of the way they do that, right, is sort of reconfiguring how they think about black interests, right? So, I mean, I think one of the important takeaways from the book and one of the questions I want to raise from the book is, you know, how do we determine black interests, right? Like, we can talk about that as if it's a taken for granted or obvious thing, but that's a hotly contested question in itself, right? Even among black Republicans, there are fights over what, you know, how do we define black interests and what's good for black people. I think, you know, the way black Republicans themselves reconcile this is to sort of think about conservative social policies as promoting business, promoting family, right? And that these, you know, sort of very broadly speaking, become principles that will uplift the black community. I think, you know, if we're being completely fair and honest about the black Republican experience, a lot of times it means standing behind the ideals while trying to disavow the current manifestation of those ideals. And that's, you know, something I saw in my research, something we're seeing in the current election, where there's this sense of, I'm a Republican, I believe in the ideals, even when the party doesn't stand up to them. And many of the black Republicans I studied, like, they aren't Republican ride or die, right? There'll be, you know, many white Republicans that'll say, not this guy, but still want to hold on to the commitment to
One of the things I found fascinating, not surprising, but fascinating, is that the persons that you talk to when given an opportunity, as I understand from your writing, when given an opportunity to be either on the record or to be anonymous in their comment, they chose to be anonymous. What did you make of that? And one way to read that is that they can be more freely in talking. The other way to read is that, you know, they're in the party, but a little bit too embarrassed to go on the record.
Right.
So which one is more accurate?
I think the former is probably more accurate, right? That this was sort of anonymity became a way to sort of open up full disclosure.
Right.
Because the experience of black Republicans within the party isn't particularly positive, right? Yeah. There was a lot of sort of complaining about being black within the party, feeling like you were sort of called on as like a racial token, right, to legitimate racist policies, right? And feeling like you aren't being heard when you want to articulate a pro-black agenda getting marginalized. So I think people wanted anonymity so they could talk freely and honestly, right? In some ways, you know, the being a black Republican, many of the activists I talked to, right, as they like being the outsider, right? For them, there's this sense of specialness of I see something no one else does, right? That you kind of get to have when you're engaged in this kind of unexpected politics. So, and for me, most of them were out to friends and family about their partisanship. So I think this was more, they're wanting to be anonymous, was more about not upsetting the apple cart within the party. Because it's a delicate dance they have to do.
Long term, the numbers of the percentage of Black Republicans is going to be the same. Is it going to grow? Is it going to shrink? Where are we headed with Black Republicans?
There seems to be no real reason to expect any sort of upward trend in it, right? I think, you know, I'd be surprised if the current election in a few weeks produces any bump in the number of Black Republicans, right? The Blacks voting for the Republican Party. Yeah. I think what could happen is the sort of destabilizing effect of Trump on the Republican Party. Yeah. What happens to the Republican Party after the election? Maybe we see a newly configured Republican Party that's sort of more moderate and temperate, right? Which then might open up things. So, but in a lot of ways, Black Republicans are sort of, you know, I think capped partly because of the decisions of the Republican Party more broadly and where they're headed.
Well, you put your finger, I think, on the pulse of where we are, which is this question that everybody's wrestling with, which we will see in the coming months and years how it gets answered. But it's the penultimate question, I think, which is, what does the Republican Party do post Donald Trump? Whether he wins or loses, how do they reshape this party given the damage that's been done to it? And is that damage irreparable? I don't know the answer to those questions, but we'll be talking about it, trying to figure it out with people like Corey D. Fields, who's the author of the new book, Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African American Republicans. Professor Fields, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Phoebe Robinson is an actress, comedian, and podcaster whose new book about being Black and female in America is called You Can't Touch My Hair. I love it. And other things I still have to explain. Phoebe, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm glad to have you. I suspect that you must be getting recognized a bit more these days. How are you handling people recognizing that face?
It's been good. Everyone's been really nice. Yeah. I'm still getting my hair touched a lot, which is annoying. I was staying in a hotel, and I was in the hotel lobby on a phone call with a friend, and this white lady was walking over, and she was smiling at me like she knew me, so I'm like, oh, it's probably from Two Dope Queens. She listens to the podcast. She wasn't saying anything. She's like, I know you're on the phone, but I just want to say you're really pretty. And I was like, thank you so much. It's so nice. I'm wearing sweatpants, no makeup. This is a struggle look for me, but I appreciate it. And then she just kept like pacing back and forth and hovering. And then she came over and just started petting my hair and just being like, you're so pretty. And I was like, okay. And then she went to the bathroom. Yeah. So that's still happening. Even though I wrote the book, people still like, let me get that for a test drive.
So I think most of us who have been Black our whole lives kind of understand this. Mm-hmm. But explain to the audience why this is an issue, why it is such an annoyance, however you want to explain it.
Yeah, I think just historically speaking, Black hair has been very controversial for this country.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't understand our hair, don't want to understand our hair, and it's not seen as beautiful or professional unless it's on a white model like Marc Jacobs with the dreadlocks during Fashion Week. And there's a lot of curiosity that tends to happen, so people just want to touch and grab.
Yeah.
And there's just doing that, for me, just doesn't feel comfortable. It's just it's a violation of my space and my body, and I feel a lot of times people just don't respect Black women's bodies, and that's why the hair is just like, I'll just grab it because I think it's cute. And it's like, okay, but I'm a person. Yeah. Ask permission.
It is such a serious issue, and yet what comedians at their best do, as you know, is to find the comedy in it. So tell me how you take an issue that seriously and then make it, like, funny.
Well, the thing is, I've changed my hair all the time. Like, on the cover, I have the fro.
Right.
This is like a low-budget Beyonce situation right now.
I like this. A low-budget Beyonce situation.
Okay. And then for a while I had braids, and I was staying with friends in LA when I came out, I think, to audition for something I didn't get. And I was staying with friends, and Dan, the husband, was there, and he was on a phone call. And, you know, black hair, we have a weave in or braids, and your hair, your real hair pushes the fake hair out. And so I got up to go to the kitchen, and just one braid fell out of my hair onto the ground. And then their dog, Dennis, started eating it. And so Dan had to dive in and take this braid out of the dog's mouth. And that was a really, like, he was just very cool. He was an ally then. He didn't question. He was just like, there's a braid that needs to be rescued. Here you go. So I think in those moments where you have, I can have fun with black hair and make it something accessible for people, I want to share in that because, you know, you want to laugh. You want to feel good. I don't want this to be like a tough history lesson about black hair and about, you know, black feminism. Like, I want people to have fun when they're reading the book.
There is this old adage, I think, that many of us, I certainly believe in, which is that, certainly being black, we know this, that at times, this is true for us and certainly true for our ancestors, that at times, if they didn't laugh, they'd cry. Sometimes you laugh to keep from crying. It is interesting to me because as a black woman, there potentially are so many things to be angry about. And yet it seems to me that you have to choose to laugh. You have to choose to find the humor in it. Just tell me about your journey trying to navigate every day being a black woman and choosing not to be angry about this insult or that, you know, put aside, but just taking it and kind of flipping it, essentially.
Well, I think I've been doing stand-up for a little over 8 years, and that is a very male, white male in particular, dominated industry.
I love that. Was so many.
Yes, so many white guys is one of my podcasts.
I love that podcast. Yeah. So many white guys.
Thank you so much. Which a lot of white guys got mad about, but I'm like, just listen to the podcast. It's woke. You'll learn something. But yeah, there's a lot of times where, for instance, like if I do a stand-up show, they will only want to book one woman because they don't want it to feel like a weird specialty show if we have more than one woman on. So you have those kind of situations that you just encounter all the time that I don't think people realize how belittling it is and like how much it's kind of pushing people aside. And so it can be tough at times, but I think doing stand-up and just I'm just going to make sure I'm the funniest that I can be. That's all I can control. I can't control if someone's going to discriminate because I'm a black woman. I can control being the best person in the lineup. So that's what I try and do.
Yeah. You mentioned the podcast. You got a couple of these things. Tell me about, for those, I mean, most of us, or many of us certainly have come to appreciate, and we do the podcast thing. A lot of people who are still trying to figure out what that is, how do I find it, why would I want to listen? Just give me a quick lesson here on how you've been able to use podcasts to advance your career and what you actually do with your podcast.
Well, I have two podcasts with WNYC, Two Dope Queens, that I co-host with Jessica Williams. And then so many...
You wrote the forward to this book?
Yeah, she did. It was a lovely forward. And then my solo...
What's that term you call her? Your wife? Your
My work wife.
My work wife.
Yeah, she's great.
Jessica Williams is your work wife. I love it. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
And then the other one's an interview show, So Many White Guys. And I think with both podcasts, Jess and I... working together and also separately, like we wanted to highlight voices that we felt were marginalized and like not represented. A lot of times stand-up comics and storytellers of color, women and people from the LGBTQ plus community don't get the platforms to be funny. And so with Two Dope Queens, we were just like, we're going to highlight that. And then sure, we'll have some white guys on, but we really want to showcase these brilliant, amazing people who are fantastic. And then I do the same thing with the interview show. Like I had on Janet Mock, who's amazing, and Gina Rodriguez. And, you know, I just have really smart conversations with Saa Minaj, like just great conversations with amazing people that I feel like a lot of times when they're interviewed, it's like, Hassan, so you're brown. What's it like to be brown in Hollywood? And it's like, well, that's not all that he is. It's not his skin color. So I want to have real conversations with people without making them the other.
Yeah. To that not being all that Hassan is, do you ever feel like, back to your hair, that for you and for other black women, you get reduced to your hair?
Yes.
I'm thinking of that India Arie song, I Am Not My Hair.
I love that song growing up. And I do, I feel there... In a certain way, black women can't do anything right. Because, you know, when I normally wear my hair, it's normally an afro. It's kind of like a Frederick Douglass moment. It's like a little bit like wild and big.
So kind of like Frederica Douglass?
It's okay, like, it's dope and awesome. And then, you know, people would be like, oh, she would be prettier if her hair was straight. And if I throw in like a summer look like this, and it's like, okay, well, how can she talk about black issues if her hair is straight? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a, for me, I want to take black hair back. Yeah. I want black women to own it. And the only way that I feel that I can do is by having fun with it and wearing my hair however I want and telling people that doesn't define who I am as a person. That doesn't mean that I'm not smart.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that I don't love myself. And you can't tell me how I feel about myself based on my hair.
Yeah. You were seriously getting your hustle on because you're acting as well.
Yeah.
So tell me how the acting is coming along.
The acting's been good. I did a small role in Broad City on Comedy Central. And now I'm working on a new Amazon show that Jill Soloway is directing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, really great.
I talk to so many young people, and I know so many young people and run into young people who are always looking for some lessons about how to navigate the journey that they're on. I mean, trying to find your way to success isn't easy for any of us, and there is no one-size-fits-all. But certainly people of color are always trying to figure out, how do I navigate from here to here? And I get more letters, and I have more young people come to speeches. They wait for the Q&A because everybody wants to get a piece of your time. Yeah. So you just got to figure out, to help them figure out how to navigate the journey. What are you learning about the journey?
I think it's hard for people of color,
and
2014 was a really hard year. I couldn't get hired on anything, writing or performing, and I really wanted to quit. That was like a really hard year. I quit my day job to work on this pilot that didn't go, so I was just freelance writing and doing unpaid stand-up gigs, and I was really like, this is too hard. I called my parents, and I was like, I'm quitting, and they told me not to quit, and I think having that really tough year of like nothing going right. Mm-hmm. And then now, 2 years later, I have a book and these podcasts and all this stuff. I would just tell people that it is going to be super hard. Mm-hmm. And you might feel like people aren't helping you because you are a person of color. So surround yourself with amazing people like Jessica Williams or, you know, I just think that having this sisterhood, in particular if you're a black woman, like, because there's not a lot of us.
Yeah.
So I think just having those deep bonds with people really helps. And then also you just have to work hard. It's really, this industry, it's not going to happen on your timeline. It never does. So you just have to remember you got into it because you love it, and you're not going to make money for a really long time, and you're going to have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I asked that question of you is because what you did, Phoebe, was to exercise your own agency. Mm-hmm. So you're right about the fact that it doesn't happen on your timeline. You're not going to make any money at the beginning. But it's one of those things where you have taken control of the reins of your own future. I mean, you wrote your book and you started your podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that what is available in today's era that wasn't available perhaps for many of us years before was the ability to do that because you can self-publish, because you can go and start your own podcast, because you can blog. And I find that sometimes people are looking for you to give them a map. And what it really boils down to oftentimes is doing what Phoebe did, which is to sort of just chart your own course.
Yeah, and it's really hard because this industry is like you're either the pretty one or you're the funny one. You're either the sloppy one or you're like the neat type A.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, most people are not just one thing.
Yeah.
And I noticed when I was auditioning a lot, it was either I was always the best friend of the girl who had the love life. I was never a romantic interest.
Yeah.
Or I was doing these like fried food commercials where it's like, girl, girl. And I had to go in and be like, why am I doing this? Philip and Octavia.
Because you do it really good. That's why. You do it so well. That's why. Yeah.
My parents are going to be like, girl. And I really just got to, I got to a place where I was like, this is not who I am. Yes, I am black, but like I listen to you too, and I'm obsessed with Oprah, and I run the gamut of pop culture stuff, and I also care about feminism, and I was like, well, maybe I should just kind of define for myself who I am and just kind of just do my own thing, and hopefully people will gravitate towards me, and I think that's really worked out.
Her name is Phoebe Robinson. Her book is called You Can't Touch My Hair and Other Things I Still Have to Explain.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Oscar and Grammy Award winner Carol Bayer Sager is one of the most prolific songwriters in pop history. Her songs have been performed by musical giants like Michael Jackson, Neil Diamond, and Aretha Franklin. Now she's telling her own story in a memoir. It's called They're Playing Our Song. Carol Bayer Sager,
it's an honor to have you on this program.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for coming to see us. You start your days every day the same way my mother starts her days, on your knees in prayer.
Yes, I do. I wasn't even going to put that in the book, but my husband said, I hope you wrote in the book about how you say your prayer every morning. And I said, why would I say that? And he said, because it's very unusual, which I didn't know, but I do. I get down on my hands and knees every morning and I say a prayer, which sets an intention for the day. And I pray for friends who are in need of healing. I pray for God's will and to have him lead me in the way that he would do what he would have me do. And I've just done it for so many years, I can't imagine not doing it.
Yeah. How did you become a person of faith? Is that a fair question?
It's a fair question because I wasn't as a young person and young child. In fact, I found little faith in my own religion because my initial family of origin was not a feeling of safety for me. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go to temple and I would see all the people outside talking about each other. And I thought, well, this doesn't feel protective or loving. So I didn't connect to that. And it was many years later, actually. I studied many different religions. I studied mm-hmm. Buddhism. I studied Hinduism. I meditated. And then I found Kabbalah, yeah. which is the spiritual arm of the Jewish religion. Some Jews don't approve of it, but I found a lot of helpful suggestions in how to change my life on a daily basis through the study of Kabbalah. And just through, I guess, so many books that I read, and I kind of have my own relationship with my higher power, but I really believe that I'm guided.
Yeah. The thing I found most fascinating about the text, about the book, particularly about your life journey, is that as a child, you are bullied, you are chubby, a very aggressive, I want to be generous here, a very aggressive mother, tough mother.
You could say that.
Yeah, a tough mother. Loved your father. Loved both your parents, but really loved your father. Tough mother. Anyway, from that childhood that you were referencing a moment ago where you said you didn't feel that kind of love, the most interesting dynamic and dichotomy for me is that for a child who grows up that way, you end up writing such beautiful love songs.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I think that childhood made me who I am today. Mm-hmm. So today I bless it. I forgive my mom completely because...
That's the point, though. You could have been bitter, though.
I could have been, but I so realized that if she had been more nurturing or less critical, I wouldn't have had the need to be seen and heard. And the safest way for me to be heard was through writing my feelings and someone else expressing them. As a little girl, I had a ventriloquist act, yeah. and the dummy could say things for me that I couldn't say for myself. So the natural extension was, well, I loved music all my life. I loved music. As a little girl, I wrote lyrics to other people's songs on the radio. Mm-hmm. And then at camp, I wrote the theme songs at camp. And it was just clear to me always that I wanted to write songs, but again, I could put my feelings out there and not have to own them because someone else was singing them. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning. And as I write in the book, songwriting became the safest lane in my life. when I was writing songs, all my fears of illness and dying went away, all my fears of the bomb exploding, all my fears of, I mean, I walked around with a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety that no one really knew, because I had a very calm facade, even though when nighttime came, all my fear remembered me and I couldn't sleep. And, you know, I wasn't very present in my own life, but in that lane of songwriting, everything was always perfect.
But that requires a courage. It requires a certain amount of transparency. Even though you aren't saying it, you still have to come out of yourself with what you put on paper. So tell me more about that process, about being courageous enough and transparent enough to put what you were feeling onto paper.
Well, I usually didn't write my lyrics out. I respond when I hear music.
Right.
And I'm probably the most collaborative person I know. And I think part of that was not having a strong self at the time. I had this ability in collaboration because I wrote with a lot of people who were going to be recording the songs, starting with Melissa Manchester and Peter Allen and onward. And so I was able to sort of morph into what I thought they needed me to be, mm-hmm. and yet stay true to my own feelings when I wrote lyrics. And when I wrote lyrics, often they were like songs to my future self. Like, I remember writing a song early on with Melissa Manchester called Home to Myself, mm-hmm. which so many women came up to me and said, oh, that song got me through a really difficult time. Well, I didn't feel that I had found that place, that home to myself at the time, but I hoped I would. And I did. Finally, I did, way later in life. But I think that many of my songs were hopes for the future. Mm-hmm. They were messages of love that I wanted to feel and wanted to give, and unrequited love. That was easy for me, 'cause that I knew from.
Yeah.
But I think some of the things that made me a really good collaborator were the same things that made me not feel completely whole as a person for a while.
There are a lot of folks, though, who are gifted and talented, as you clearly are, who don't like to run in the collaboration lane because it requires sharing, it requires what collaboration requires, working with someone else, as opposed to letting your artistic vision guide the process. So how did you get comfortable with sharing the stage, sharing the spotlight, sharing the creativity?
Well, I love the feedback.
Yeah.
I just love the feedback. I love, first of all, whoever I write with in my music room or theirs, there's sort of an unspoken rule. Nobody's going to edit anybody.
Right.
And as my friend David Foster, another great songwriter, producer,
we'll talk about the prayer a little bit later.
He says, don't strangle it while it's in the cradle.
Yeah.
So I don't edit myself.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'll say a line and you can say, Carol, that's awful. And that's okay. I'll just keep. But I love the feedback that as I'm hearing your melody and I'm singing lyrics and maybe even changing a line or two of your melodies, except with Burt Bacharach, where he didn't let me change a single note.
Yeah.
But I like you to say, no, give me something better. As opposed to if I was doing it alone, I didn't have that voice that would say to myself, give me something better.
But you're never offended by that, though?
No, I like it. I welcome it.
Yeah.
I welcome it because maybe I'm just so used to it as a child, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it makes me dig deeper and reach for more to have that feedback.
Yeah. Since you mentioned David Foster, and I'll cut in right quick because I wanted to make sure that I didn't forget. Tell me about this, about The Prayer, the song that you've done more than one, but the collaboration with David Foster.
David Foster and I wrote The Prayer for a unsuccessful animated film called The Quest for Camelot,
mm-hmm.
and it was the young girl, the heroine, was going off into a dangerous situation, as most all do in animated films,
mm-hmm.
and I said to David, I think we should write a prayer that the mother sings as she lets her daughter go, and he said, that's a good idea, and he started playing. He just, you know, he's so facile, so he just starts playing some chords. And I think my most famous phrase throughout my life is when I hear something that I sort of like, that they're just about to pass by and go to something else, I go, what's that? Play that again. Play that again. I want to hear that. And so he went back, and I said, that's so pretty, but play around there. And he's played a line, and I went, I love that. Say, let's say, I pray you'll be our eyes. And then all of a sudden, words that weren't there 3 minutes before start to come to me and flow with what he's finding as a melody. And it's my favorite way to write, because I feel like we're one. I feel like when it's all right, when the lyric fits the melody and the melody fits the lyric and the song becomes more because of the marriage of the two, that's my favorite way to write. And I have to be cautious because David is so brilliant and can make anything sound great in 1 second, as can Babyface, as can Carole King, as can All My Life. I've written with people who you hear them and you go, oh, wow, this is a hit. And then you have to listen again to go, is it really? Or do they just make it sound so good on first listen? Yeah. So with David, we got Celine Dion to sing the song in the film. And then we got Andrea Bocelli to sing it with her at the end credit. And when I heard that, I just went, this is everything I've ever wanted to say in my life. And it's greater than even the song was. It took on an even higher meaning when it was sung by these two heaven-like voices together.
They're playing our song.
Thank you, Travis.
By Carole Bayer Sager on the New York Times bestseller list. I just saw it before I came
here. Yes, I'm glad you said that. I couldn't believe it.
I could. I expected no less. Good to have you on the program.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Ellis Hall, the former lead vocalist and keyboardist for Tower of Power, known as the Ambassador of Soul, has performed with a multitude of musical icons, including Stevie Wonder, James Taylor, and his musical mentor, Ray Charles. He's also played with some of the world's best orchestras and has created his own symphony shows. His latest is called Soul Unlimited. He joins us now to talk about the new project.
I think there's so many people who have heard your voice on soundtracks, on TV commercials. Where have you been all these years, for those who've never heard the name Ellis Hall?
Well, you know, I had a bit of visibility with a group called the Tower of Power.
Absolutely.
And after that, I started doing television and movies, behind the scenes, but always there. Now, I made an appearance in the movie Big Mama's House, and folks saw me as the organist,
Absolutely.
Pop up and act a fool. You know, and the operative word is F-O-O apostrophe, fool.
Yeah.
So, after saying that, I've just been around doing what I do through the grace of God, recording, performing, writing, singing. I'm so honored to be this vessel.
Yes. Tell me about your friendships with two other great artists who happen to have been sightless.
Yes, sir.
Stevie Wonder and your friend Ray Charles. Tell me about your friendship with Stevie and Ray.
Well, one thing's for sure is, yes, we do talk about driving cars.
Yeah.
No. Stevie, oh, love, what a spirit. I mean, and Ray, if he didn't think you were bringing it, he would lay you out. But if he felt you were coming to the highest highs with your A game, he would exalt you. And, you know, that's the thing of working with Ray, especially for the last few years of his life. He called me his protege, but as I lovingly say, George Benson got a hold of him and said, I had him first.
Yeah.
But working with Ray and Stevie, bottom line.
And being on Ray's label.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely signed to, I was the last one besides Ray, actually on his label, Crossover Records. And Ray would say to me, boy, you got so much music in you, it's scary. And I called him Papa Ray. I said, look who's talking, Papa Ray. But we happened to have a couple of things in common, Ray and I. One was having had vision and lost it and seeing the red clay of Georgia and the great commonness of how we loved our mothers.
Yeah.
You know, we had that. And then he said to me, he said, Ellis, you need to be doing symphonies. And I said, now, Papa Ray, it would be great. How do I do it? Mm-hmm. He made a couple of phone calls and the rest is history. Wow. And the symphonies, my brother, one show running called Ellis Hall presents Ray, Motown, and Beyond. Mm-hmm. So I take all these songs and Ellisize them. Mm-hmm. The second one
I like that, Ellisize them.
That's right. And the second one is Ellis Hall Soul Unlimited.
What is an Ellis Hall symphony like?
Well,
what's the evening like?
It's 81-piece orchestras. And I get them, you know, they read what's on the ink, but right. I get them to jam with me.
Right.
I get them to say, okay, we're taking a song like Higher and Higher, Jackie Wilson, mm-hmm. and take it to another level. And I get so excited, I start jumping up and down.
Let me go back to a point you made earlier, Ellis, when you talked about some of the things that you and Ray had in common.
Yes, sir.
Both of you were born with sight.
Yes, sir.
And went blind. Tell me the Ellis Hall story of going blind.
Well, it was at 18, okay, first of all, a year into my birth, my mom and pops noticed that my eyes were developing differently. First of all, from brown, they turned to blue. What had happened, congenital glaucoma, which I tell everybody, get checked. Mm-hmm. Glaucoma has no symptoms. Please get checked to keep the pressure down. So they noticed, and I was born in Savannah, Georgia, raised partway in Claxton, mm-hmm. and they said, what are we going to do? My mom used to cry at night. What are we going to do to get my baby to make his own way? They had the brilliant thought to move me up to Boston, Massachusetts, but going to a school called Perkins. Please let me give a special shout out to the amazing programs at Perkins School for the Blind, where Miss Helen Keller and others have developed their great skills of interdependence. Mm-hmm. And also a shout to my dear friend, Mr. Kevin Bright. He's a co-creator of Friends. We've known each other a while. And he has made some amazing programs over there. Again, to show that nothing stops us but us. But having said that, I used to wrestle and play football. They didn't tell me I shouldn't be doing contact sports. Mm-hmm. So at 18, a gentleman hit my good eye, my left eye, by accident. And I always tell friends lovingly, oh, come on, the real deal is I didn't pay my electric bill on time, so lights out. You know, come on.
How do you process, though? How do you process being able to see
and then
for
not,
18 years and then not?
Because I remember what I call the important things, looking at the pretty ladies and sunsets.
Yeah, in that order, huh?
Yeah. And I used to, because they told me that my sight could go away at any time, I used to practice my instruments in the dark. Once I learned I was going to be in this music madness,
yeah.
I learned how to play drums, basses, guitars, keyboards, whatever it took. In fact, I was doing the beatbox way before they thought it was the beatbox, because I don't mess up the mic like... You know, that kind of vibe. Come on now.
I love this. I am fascinated. As long as I've known you, I never knew this story. When you knew you were going to go blind,
yes, sir.
You literally started practicing all your instruments in the dark?
Yes, I would literally, for instance, my bass, I would take it and stand. I'd turn, you know, the lights off, or I'd stand in a closet so I wouldn't disturb anyone. So I'd play it over and over, literally, until my fingers bled, so I could get to know the instrument by feeling. For instance, when I go to someone's drum set, mm-hmm. I'll feel it for about 2 seconds or 3 seconds and try and play it like it's my own.
Mm. Wow.
That's what it does. Nothing. I call myself the poster boy of PPD, perseverance, persistence, and determination. Hallelujah.
Yeah. What role? I've known you for so long, so I know you to be a person of faith.
Yes.
What role has your faith played in helping you navigate this peculiar journey?
Well, it's knowing, first of all, in learning that I become the vessel, I know that that power that is behind this vessel never fails. So all I have to do through any peaks and valleys in my life, keep walking, keep laughing, keep loving, keep letting people know without a doubt, I have the choice to wake up smiling. We all have that choice to wake up smiling, mm-hmm. or as I say, wake up and be on the other side of the bed as a snarkosaurus.
Yeah.
We do. We have that choice. So I'd rather get up and smile. It doesn't mean that my day won't be bad. I can recognize that, but thank God, the attitude of gratitude, thanking God that I'm here, standing, walking, and can celebrate my day, and maybe somebody else who might want to celebrate with me.
Yeah. See, that's amazing that somebody else might want to celebrate with you, because
yes.
I have never, and I mean this sincerely,
yes, sir.
As many times as I have seen you or talked to you or hung out with you or even yes. gotten voicemail messages,
yeah.
which I get from you routinely, and I love hearing them, I've never known you to be in a bad mood. I mean, every time I see you, you always lift my spirits and everybody's around you, but you gotta have some bad days though, man.
Well, you know, the cheapest therapy, brother.
Yeah.
This little thing right here.
Okay.
You know, just,
all right.
You know, yeah. how can you, if you, I mean, you can't feel bad.
Yeah.
If you're ringing the fire alarm,
yeah.
come on.
Yeah.
You can't help yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the train's coming through.
Yeah.
You have a choice to get on the train or get out the way, because yeah. it's going to come.
Yeah.
And that's what I say. I tell you, take folks on a journey, be it symphonies or our festival gigs with the band.
Yeah.
We're going to, you know, we're going to make you shout,
yeah.
you know. And if we're singing a slow song, you know, if you're with someone special, you want to hold them close enough,
yeah.
you know, leaving enough room for the Holy Ghost.
Yeah. Tell me about this unique gift you have, and there are a lot of artists who have it,
yes.
who can take a song and cover it. But you don't just take a song and cover it. To use your word, you elicize it.
That's right.
Tell me how when you hear a song, you know whether or not it is a potential to be elicized.
Well, you know, that goes back to Ray. Mm-hmm. Ray was not afraid of doing country music.
Yeah.
And back then, folks. Black folks in country music,
yeah.
that was unheard of.
Yeah.
Modern sounds of country turned the music industry on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, if I hear a song like I Really Want to See It Tonight,
yeah.
it used to be called I'd Really Love to See It Tonight, mm-hmm. England Janet John Ford Coley,
oh, great song,
and
yeah.
Parker McGee, mm-hmm. a dear friend, I called him up and I played it over the phone and he was crying like a baby because he said, because I said, if you slow that down
yeah.
and make it a love soul ballad,
yeah.
and you can make anything a soul situation, thereby the title Ellis Hall Soul Unlimited,
mm-hmm.
take songs that you don't regularly think are soul and make them your own. And that moment that song came from had already been created. So
yeah.
why create the same moment?
Mm-hmm.
Why not create a new one? A
different moment, yeah.
Yes.
In case you have never heard, well, you've heard him before, whether you know it or not. In case you never knew his name,
yes.
Ellis Hall, you should do what some of my staff have already done. Just go online and
yes.
Google Ellis Hall, and you can get a good feel of all kind of stuff that he's done that you can find online. But if you
at www.ellishall.com.
Yep. There you go. I was about to hit it. He's going to close us out with an original song. Here
yes.
comes Ellis Hall performing Girl, You're Not in Kansas Anymore.
Storytelling time about a friend of mine. All right. Good God Almighty. Standing by the highway, gonna do it her way, hitching a ride on anything out of town. She's LA bound, oh. Flagging down a diesel, hanging with the weasel, let her off somewhere in the desert sun. She wouldn't give him some time. You think the grass is greener?
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.